Hey, everybody. My name is Regina, and I'm a very grateful member of Al-Anon Nalatine. Can y'all hear me okay? If I got to talk, y'all got to hear. She mentioned getting out of myself to do for Mickey. Folks have no idea what Mickey does for me. And Kitty also. For several years, we've traveled around, I don't know, 10 plus or minus years, been coming up here with Mickey. And what I've gotten from her is far, far, far more than anything I've done for her. Bar none. I'm supposed to tell you in a general way what it was like, what happened, and what I'm like today. There's not a whole lot of what it was like because I was born into this disease. I hear an echo. I hope it sounds better for you guys. I was born into this disease. My earliest memories was adults drinking. That's just the way it was. It wasn't bad. It wasn't, it was good, actually. Come home from school, and in the evenings, especially the weekends, we cooked out, we grilled. There was always cans of Falstaff and Pabst Blue Ribbon. Adults drank and smoked and partied and laughed and played music and had a good time. And the more they drank, the more I could do. They started paying more attention to each other and less attention to us kids. And I didn't see anything wrong with that. Come bedtime, I'd go to bed and they'd do whatever they did and it was all good. All of my friends' parents drank. So early on, I don't remember that being an unusual thing. My friends would come over to my house after school, and Mama made these little popsicles out of Kool-Aid. So kids knew that they'd come to my house, they'd get ice cream, and every once in a while, we'd get store-bought ice cream. And I had this swing set thing, big monkey bar thing in the yard, so all the kids would come to my house and play on that. So it was not bad early on, first, second grade, and before that, but like I said, my earliest memories is adults drinking. I never remember adults not drinking. That was just the way it was. Later on, my mother and stepfather got divorced. Drinking got cranked up, and it got to where late in the evenings it wasn't so much fun anymore. It ended in arguments. And I'd get ushered off to bed, but I could hear things flying and hitting the walls and the screaming and yelling and stuff. And then they got divorced, and then my mother's drinking really cranked up at that point. I thought his drinking was, he drank more or worse or whatever from a 8-year-old or, however your perception is when you're 8. But after the divorce, Mama really, really started drinking. It wasn't Falstaff anymore. It was wine by the gallons. And before, even with all the drinking, he went to work every day. Never missed work, and he was retired military, but he was also a firefighter. And I remember conversations at the breakfast table. Mama would be mad because he'd get drunk the night before, and he was shaking so hard he couldn't hold his coffee. And he worked at Lockheed Air Force Base, and they'd do these training where they had to climb way up on these towers. And she'd be mad because he didn't tell her that he had to climb 300 foot up in the air, and he was shaking so hard he couldn't hold his coffee. She was afraid he was going to fall because he's too hungover to do that. But he'd get up and clean himself up and go to work and shine his shoes, and off he'd go, and he never didn't work. Well, after they got divorced, Mama had a hard time keeping a job. She drank. Her drinking was different. She drank until she passed out, then she'd come to and drink some more until she passed out wherever she was. So coming home from school, I didn't know which Mama I was going to get. It may be, she may be in there cleaning the house and cooking and all the curtains open and, happy Mama. Or she may be passed out on the couch or the bed or the floor or something. I didn't know. So I learned not to let those friends come over. There wasn't any more ice cream after school. When teachers wanted to see her, I'd make excuses why she couldn't come. She had to work or this or that, because I knew she may or may not be there. And after a few times, I learned pretty quick not to involve her in any of my stuff, just to do my thing at school and so on and so forth. Well, kept on like that for a while. And I'm sure I don't remember doing it, but I'm sure I was probably harassing her about drinking by that time. I mean, that's what I do. That's me. That's what I do. But she came to me when I was about 12. We was back in Alabama. When I was 12, she came to me and said she was going to need to go away for a little while so she could quit drinking. And I didn't understand that. I'm like, well, why don't you just quit drinking? Why you got to go somewhere and do it? Why can't you just do it right here? I was staying with my grandparents. We were both living with my grandparents at that time. And she tried to explain to me about treatment. And I don't think anybody 12-stepped her. She just got scared. She hit her bottom and got scared all by herself. And found a treatment center in Birmingham that she could go to and get sober. The word AA had never been mentioned at that point. It was just treatment center was the only terminology I remember, and stopped drinking. So she went off, and she got weekend pass, and she started trying to explain this thing to me as a disease and what she was doing in treatment. It didn't make any sense whatsoever. I had no idea how this connected to that. And in my mind, if she just quit drinking, it'd be okay. But it didn't work that way. She got out of treatment and came home, started talking about going to AA, but she came home and promptly went right to her bar and got drunk that night. I think a couple of days of that, and she did whatever she needed to do, and she didn't drink anymore after that. Very, very confusing for me. By that time, I'm angry, very rebellious, and doing what I want to do, because she wasn't around to parent me much, so I could pretty much get away with whatever I wanted to do, and I was angry, very, very angry by that time. Couldn't talk to me, couldn't explain anything to me. So she started going to AA, and every day, I don't know if they told her 90 and 90 or whatever, I think she heard 5 years, because every day she'd go to a meeting, 7 days a week, and that went on for a very, very long time, sometimes twice a day. If she wasn't at work, she'd go to noon meeting and then go to the night meeting. And she was dragging me around to all these meetings with her, and which I guess early on it was okay, but what I remember very, very early on, every night just about, which back then everybody smoked in meetings, so everybody had 2 cigarettes in their hand and big cloud of smoke, and people cooked and brought food to meetings. This is pre-microwave days. So they cooked in the oven on the stove and brought food, and you ate a meal, not cookies out of a bag, but you ate a full meal at the meeting. And I'd start whining about, do I have to go tonight? And she'd say, well, do you want to eat supper tonight? Because that's where we eat. That's where we were. On the weekends, we ate at anniversaries and fixed a plate and took home to eat for supper. I don't think she cooked at all during that period of time. She's too busy at the meetings. I guess I got what I realized was my first real, real resentment toward AA. I thought if she quit drinking, then I'd get my mom back. And she quit drinking, and AA got my mom. Because she said, I need to change my playgrounds and my playmates, and she did. All those people that we knew, they were gone. Those places we used to go, didn't go there anymore. And everything about our life revolved around AA. Everything. I want to stop and tell a little story here about Mickey. Actually, about Jim. I don't remember knowing Jim, but Mama says I did. I don't remember, but Jim Hawkins was the person that introduced my mother to AA. He went around to a lot of treatment centers, and he went out there and introduced the group, I think their first week in treatment, to AA, and they started bringing meetings into that treatment center while she was there. And she told me she didn't know what that man said or didn't understand what that man said, but she knew to do what he said. She didn't know what it meant or understand it, but she knew just the way he said it from the heart to do what he said, and it would be okay. Said he took them all out underneath the tree in the grass, and they sat on the ground, and they talked about AA and alcoholism. And he told his what it was like for him. So by that, you know, and I was a little kid. I didn't know Mickey or Jim or whatever, which Mama said he was around at anniversaries and stuff, and I knew him. But many, many years later, after Jim had passed away, Mickey calls work one day, and Mom answers the phone, and she asks for me, and she asks who it is. She's screening calls for salespeople, and put her on hold, and so we talked for a minute, and then when I hung up, Mama said, "I don't mean to pry, but Mickey Hawkins, is she any kin to Jim Hawkins?" And I said, "Well, yeah, that, you know, Jim passed away a couple years ago." And she said, "Yeah, I heard about that." And I said, "That's his wife." And all those years, I didn't know that. You know, Mickey and I had been going here and yonder, and I had no idea. Never even occurred to me. You know, I hadn't thought about that man that introduced her to AA in 10 years, probably. Full circle there. And there's more to come. There's multiple generations of that story, but we'll leave that right there. So anyway, somebody in AA told Mama, probably several people, that she needed to take me to Alateen, and that Alateen would do for me what AA was doing for her. So she took me to Alateen kicking and screaming. Back then, Alateen wasn't like it is now. You know, we had one book, and they'd put us in a room, and here's the steps. Y'all need to read these and talk about them. Well, teenagers ain't going to do that. So I don't remember a lot about it. I know today I picked up and learned and did more than I gave myself credit for many, many years. It came back around. And so I moved on, and Mom was doing her thing in AA. In school and involved in doing what teenagers do, and started college and kind of meandered away from the program. I never did, like, say, quit program. I just kind of meandered away. Got busy with life and work and school and all those things. And I would use, for a really long time, I used the program like a pain pill. If life was poking at me, I knew where to go. I'd go to a meeting or an anniversary, or every once in a while, I'd run into somebody at the grocery store or the quick market or something, and say, "Hey, so-and-so's anniversary is this weekend," and I'd go, you know, for something to do, for the fun of it, and see people and all that. I remember when I was little, all those people in AA, they wanted to pat me on the head and tell me how cute I was and hug me. I didn't want anybody hugging me, and they'd make me wash their ashtrays and their coffee cups, and I thought, "Yeah, you just saying that so I'll wash the ashtrays for you." But the AAs would say, if somebody asks you to do something in this program, you just do it. You don't ask why or anything, you just do it. And I remember that seed being planted early on. And recently, you know, sometimes you have conflict and you can't. But for the most part, I still have that in my gut. If I need to say no, or I need to think about it or whatever, you know, that tightening up in your gut. Because you're supposed to just say yes, I'll be glad to right there. And no matter what it is. So anyway, fast forward a little bit, get out of college, go to work. Went to work for a little company up in North Alabama, and right out of college, I mean. And the guy that owned the company, strong-willed feller, and I got to noticing that people at work would come to my office. Our offices was right next door to each other. They'd come to my office and say, would you go ask him this? And I'm like, "Well, you go ask him. What's wrong?" Well, he was always barking at everybody, and they didn't, you know, kind of walking on eggshells or whatever. Well, for me, those survival skills I learned growing up, that behavior seemed perfectly normal. I mean, that's just the way people like that behave. I didn't see anything wrong with the way he behaved or talked to people or anything. You know, that was just the way it was. What is wrong with you people? So come to find out, he liked to drink. He liked to drink a lot. But he didn't drink like my mama, so I didn't think nothing about it. You know, he came to work every day. He was never saw him drunk or hungover, or he never missed. It didn't seem, from my perspective then, just during the day, it didn't seem like, you know, he had any consequences. Later I found out he did, but so anyway, we did that for a couple years, and then and I'm still using program as a pain pill here now. I'm not working any program or in any program at this point. I got a lot of knowledge, and that's it, which is completely useless. So for about the next 5 years, moved to different states chasing jobs and this and that. Well, we both end up back in Birmingham and had an opportunity to start a business. Well, I went to him because he knew how to run a business. I didn't know how to run a business. I didn't know how to sell. I knew how to make this product, and that was it. And we had kept in touch pretty much over the years. Matter of fact, I think my dad, my next stepdad, had bailed him out of jail a time or two. Is that me? Harvey's back there pushing buttons and moving levers. So anyway, had this opportunity to go in business, and we kind of went in business together. I'd been making this product pretty much out of the trunk of my car, and within a year, we didn't really form a business. We just kind of rented a building, bought some equipment, and started doing it. We was 2 years into that business before we ever had a partnership agreement. There was that level of trust and ignorance. And 50-50, too. There's no way out. Two strong-willed people hitting heads, and nobody higher authority than the other. Well, my mother had moved back from Virginia at that point, and she came in, set us up a set of books. She was a bookkeeper. Came in, set us up a set of books, and she started planting the seed. When we would start arguing, she'd say, "Honey, I think he might be one of us." And I'm like, "No, he didn't drink like you did. He don't. I mean, look at him. He's sober. He's at work. He's never lost a job because he couldn't get up and go to work. And he don't wreck cars, and he don't, you know, this and that and the other. So there's no way he can be one of y'all." Well, a couple years into it, in 1995, things were kicked up. I have no idea to this day. I don't know, but with his drinking and our fighting. And it was his behavior. I never had a problem with his drinking because I saw him at work. It was the behavior that wasn't working for me anymore. In 1995, my stepfather got kidney disease and passed away late that year. And I remember thinking, by that time, I'm thinking maybe he does have a drinking problem. I think he probably does. But I can't deal with both of these things at the same time. I'm going to deal with this, and then I'll deal with that. Well, after he passed away, I looked in the phone book. And I got this idea in my mind that he had a brain tumor, that tumor was growing and putting pressure on a certain part of his brain, and that's why he was behaving like that. It didn't have anything to do with his drinking. And even after all those years around AA, that's where my thinking would go. So I looked in, I said, "We need some help." And I looked in the phone book, and there was an ad for an industrial psychologist. I thought, that's what we need. We're industrial, and he's psycho, so we can get some help. And so I called and made an appointment, went and talked to this man. But for the grace of God, I probably picked out the one mental health person in the city of Birmingham that knew anything about alcoholism. At the first meeting, he said, "I think your business partner has a drinking problem." And I'm like, "No, let me tell you what a drinking problem looks like. Denial is very thick." So I met with him a couple of times, and he asked me if I could get him to come in, and we did. So for the next, I got convinced pretty quick. So for the next 3 years, it was my mission in life to get him in treatment. And we'd go and talk to this psychologist, and mostly just scream and yell at each other the whole time I was there. I don't know how much good came from it. But I certainly needed help because Ray, that's his name, and I have permission to use his name. He was just stubborn. He told me one time that I was the most hard-headed person he knew besides himself. So anyway, how it happened, I don't know, but the first 5 years, our business doubled in size every year. We started out just me and him, and at the end of 5 years, we had 25 people and a bunch of equipment, and we started building a building. Why would I do that? You know, we're not holding on very good here, but we were, you know, we didn't need more space. So it took a year to build that building, and I thought, you know, sometime during that year, I think I hit my bottom. And oh, and I had gone back to Al-Anon by this time. Sometime in late 95, early 96, I started going to Al-Anon, and now I was going 7 days a week. Going 7 days a week and getting sicker by the minute. Couldn't get off step one because I couldn't be powerless over my business. What did God know about running a business? I was powerless over him, and I knew that, and I got that. Things were unmanageable, and I got that. But my business, you know, it was my job to have power over that business. And I didn't think God knew how to do that. So about 3 years, he decided one day, we'd gotten into a huge argument, and he picked up the phone, called the treatment center, and checked himself in. And we had just moved into the new building, but I had decided it, somewhere around in there, I'd hit my bottom and decided that I was going to get my name off that business. Business was doing good. It was making money. But we just couldn't go forward like this. And so I hired an attorney to just get my name off, sue him. And he said, well, misbehaving is not against the law. Well, figure out something, make up something, just, you know, do something. Get me out of this. And so he drew up some papers, and he fake signed it like he had a seal. He sealed it like he'd went through the court or whatever, but it was all just faked. It was not. And so I presented him with these papers and told him I wanted out. Well, he wadded them up and threw them at me. He never even read them. So anyway, he went to treatment, and he struggled. And by that point, we was having a real hard time communicating anything. Talk about clearing a room. We could both get in the same room at the same time, make eye contact, and everybody would leave. I don't care, lunch break, it didn't matter. They, you know, everybody just scramble. And we had a lot of power like that. Two very strong-willed people butting heads, and that's all we did. And it got to where we just argued for arguing, I guess. I don't know. This disease was had a pretty good hold on us, even though I was in program at that time and working the steps and doing the deal. It still, you know, this is cunning, baffling, and powerful. I kind of, you know, I was ashamed of myself because I knew I had history. I knew I'd been taught. But that's just where it takes you. That's just what it does. So when he come out of treatment, he said he started going to AA like they told him. Well, when he was in treatment, his counselor started calling me, wanting me to come to family week. And I said, no, I'm not family, and I go to Al-Anon. I couldn't imagine what they had to offer. Very arrogant, very, very arrogant. Couldn't imagine what they had to offer me that Al-Anon didn't. And I just kept saying no, and every day his counselor would call me, and every day I'd say, is he an alcoholic yet? Well, no, not yet. So about 3 weeks into it, his counselor called, and he gave me the same old spiel, you need to come to family week, but he had a different tone in his voice. And I said, isn't he alcoholic yet? And we had the same conversation for like 3 weeks, every day, 7 days a week. And he said, yeah, he became one last night. And I said, okay, I'll get on the airplane and see y'all whenever, you know, Sunday or whenever it started. And he came out and he went to AA. And this is a story I don't know that Mickey's, Kitty's heard me tell either. The first week he was out, you know, AA meetings are not the easiest thing to find if you don't know your way around town. And he didn't know his way around Birmingham real well, so I took it upon myself to make sure he knew where meetings were. I wasn't going to get involved in his recovery, but he at least needed to know where to go. And so one night, I don't know, he'd been home from treatment about a week maybe, and we're headed south to go to a meeting down in Hoover. And it was now not a meeting at the same time that I frequented a lot. And he starts in. He gets in the truck. We're in my truck, and he starts in. Yak, 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 yak. And I said, Ray, just stop. Shut up. Just don't talk. And it kept on, 20, 30 minutes. So I got off at an exit at the Oxmoor Road, got in the turn lane to go back home, and he kept on. So I put the truck in park, got out, and walked to a gas station and hid from him. Left him sitting there at the red light in the passenger seat in my truck. Well, he figured it out when the cars behind started blowing their horn. He had to get out and go around and get in the driver's seat. I called Mama to come get me, and we never talked about that. We never, ever had a conversation about that, but it was like I was showing him that he needed to shut up when I told him to. So anyway, we got in our own corners at that point, and for about 2 years, we decided that we needed to physically separate. So we rented our old building back in the industrial park and split up the equipment. He kind of builds one part of the business, and I do the other. There's a pretty good line there, so we could do that. And And you get that forklift, and I'll get this one. You can have that truck, I'll take this one. And we just split it up right down the middle, and he got what he needed, and I got what I needed to go forward. And Mama was there, and at this point, she was about 20 years sober. And she was throwing slogans at both of us, keeping us separated, keeping us civil. And she was there for him, more so than for me. But when he moved to the other building, she said, I'm going with him. You got people. He didn't have anybody. And so they go down the road, and for 2 years, he stuck in a building with somebody with 20 years sobriety. So when he started doing his thing, he had somebody to remind him program, not to tell him what a bad person he was. I was going to say an ugly word, but I better not do that. So he did his recovery, and I did mine, and we started growing. We really, really started growing. A couple of years, we came back together under the same roof. A little awkward at first, but, you know, we're half sponsors and sponsoring and doing the deal. I'd gotten involved in service work. He'd gotten involved in service work. Today, we both serve on a couple of the committees together, which is a miracle. The business is still alive. Anybody wonders if this program works in business, we've been at it 22 years and we're both still alive. And the business is alive. The economy's been hard on it, but we've done the right things. It's not been, you know, it's not been on us. The psychologist asked us one time if either one of us had suicidal tendencies. And we both laughed and said, homicidal maybe. Because it's a wonder one of us not dead and the other one in jail, because we were just that wound up. Let's see how much time I have. I always run short, so I wrote down some stories. So I got a lot of stories in recovery. No. Everybody thought we were a couple, but no. I think we would have killed each other if we'd had that aspect of the relationship. We were just straight up business partners. Him and my dad got to being friends, and while he was alive, out of respect for him, I think we stayed sane. And after he died, things really, really progressed, I think, on a lot of levels. But anyway, in recovery, I'm doing service work, he's doing service work. We're in our own corners and not messing with each other's recovery. We're just doing our own thing. Started going, had a group that called my home group for many years, and there was this one lady. Every week she'd announce, you know, we need to get some jobs filled, somebody to be treasurer and GR and all this stuff. And every week when she'd say that, everybody'd look at their feet. And it was a pretty good group. It was a healthy group. We were in the traditions. And so one week she said that. I said, we need to just do this. I'd gotten a hold of that book. When I got busy, I got better. Started reading some stuff in there, and I was ready to get busy. I was on fire in the program. And so I said, guys, we need to have a business meeting and talk about this. So we did in a couple of weeks, and somebody asked me if I wanted to be GR. Sure, yes, you know, that when somebody asks you to do something, just do it. I had no idea what a GR was, never heard of it. And so I learned that night, and somebody said, you need to do this and do that. So I started doing that. That took me to area assembly. And there I saw people arguing over money, arguing over business stuff, not, you know, life stuff, but business stuff. And then at the end of the meeting, everybody was hugging and laughing and having a good time. Well, that taught me how to use this program in business, in outside of personal relationships. And a huge, huge lesson for me. I still go to area assembly. That was a whole bunch of years ago. I go whether I have a job or not. I was GR for that group a couple of times and had some other jobs over the years. I actually have a job this time. I do the sound stuff. It means haul that equipment back and forth every day, every week, which is fun. It's a perfect job for me because I'm really busy during the with work and school and such that I just have to focus on right there. I'm 100% right there, so that's a good job for me. We both busy in service, and I think we've been kind of winding down a little bit. Matter of fact, last year or so, up until about the last 6 months, I kind of backed off on my meetings a little bit. I still went to the roundups and still went to area assembly and still did all my service jobs. But meetings got to be hit and miss. Well, I got asked to do this like three or four places right in a row, boom, 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 within a couple of weeks. And I really appreciate that. And it's like, oh, man, I need to go to meetings. You can't tell your story if you're not doing a deal. So I told Kitty, I said, this, you know, that's God doing for me what I can't do for myself. It's 7 o'clock at night after I've been at it 10, 12, 14 hours. There's just not another 3 hours in me. And I was like, well, I got to reset my priorities. And so for the last 6 months, I reset my priorities. Give my program a little more, give my recovery time a little more priority. And that's a good thing for me because I'll meander away. You know, I've done that a number of times. I'll meander away and then I come back and meander away. I guess I get what I need, but pain motivates me. When I'm in pain, I will be right there on the front row every time. A couple of things I forgot to tell. I'm going to just tell some stories now. In service, going places, doing things. I mean, y'all always see me up here with Mickey. Mickey and I have traveled all over the place. I became Mickey's driver. They'd asked her to speak, and I'd get to drive. So that took us to a lot of places. And sometimes she'd just call me up and say, hey, you want to go to so-and-so's anniversary? And it's like, yeah. And Kitty had called and said, yeah, if you know so-and-so's anniversary, well, let's go to that. So we get in the car and go. Alateen, I need to touch base back on that. That has been a huge, huge part of my recovery. I've brought a couple of kids up here over the years, but this is kids get bored up here. That's what I like about it. I can get bored up here, but kids don't do well in that environment. They need a lot of stimulation. But I think it was in 99 or 2000, a lady called and asked me to sponsor the Alateen group at Center Point. And I was really rude to the lady. I said, why would you ask somebody like me to do a job like that? I don't have any kids. I don't know anything about kids. I don't want to know anything about kids. Why would you ask me to do that? And she said, well, because you grew up in Alateen and you can relate to what they got to say. I said, okay, let me talk to my sponsor about this one. And I knew that, you know, it was over then because she didn't think I should not do anything. And her answer was, you don't have a good reason not to. And she said, give it 6 months, see how it goes, and then we'll go from there. So at the end of 6 months, it's like, okay, let's give it another 6 months. And early on, the first few months, it's like I'd leave the Alateen and I'd call somebody, I need a meeting. Kids are brutally honest. I mean, it just, you know, we complicate things. We try to attach all this other stuff, and it's just plain and simple. You know, let go and let God means let go and let God. They just let go. When you give them a tool, they just use it like it is. They don't muddy it up like we do. We complicate things. So it ended up, I sponsored that group for about 10 years, plus or minus, probably more plus than minus, probably about 11 years. But in the process, I got to recover from my childhood, which I addressed, but not at a very deep level, in Al-Anon. You just don't talk about that kind of stuff that often in Al-Anon. But listening to those kids talk about this and that and the other, mostly it was about the school teacher and, you know, other things, their friends, very little about mom and dad. But when I'd hear them share and see how they felt, I could identify with that. And that opened that up for me. So all those years I was spent with those kids, I was recovering from my childhood. All those kids are grown up now and have kids of their own and jobs and cars and houses and dogs and cats and the deal. At work today, you know, ever since Ray got in AA, we've had program people around the shop. You know, you never know who's going to drop in just to say hello. One day at work, a truck pulled up and the guy come out and I walked out and I hugged him. And when I went back in, we unloaded the truck, and he left, and the guy, somebody in the shop said, I assume you know them. I said, yeah, why? And they said, well, you're not in the habit of going out and hugging the truck drivers. It was somebody from the program that we knew. But there, you never know when somebody's going to show up just to say hello, and there's a lot of hugging going on when that happens. I don't like to not be hugged today. I like hugs today, unlike when I was a kid. Mama said I was like hugging a telephone pole when I was a kid. Stiffen up. Anger and rebellious. But at work, and we didn't plan it this way, just kind of meandered, but I was thinking, running through the list, we've got alcoholics, of course, but we've also got spouses of alcoholics, widows of alcoholics, four generations. One of the little Alateens that I sponsored, matter of fact, he came up here with me. He works there. Kitty's grandson works for us. Mickey's great-grandson works for us, lives two doors down. And I watch his name's John and Trey. I watch John and Ray out there building something or whatever, you know, and I think that boy's great-grandfather introduced my mother to AA, you know, and now Ray's sober and we're doing, you know, it's just full circle, total about even today. There's very few earth people in my life. I just have a hard time making friends with earth people because they don't get it. They just don't get it. The survival skills that I learned growing up, I wonder when life things happen, I can think, oh, that's easy. You know, we can get through this. But people that don't have this program, it's a real struggle for them, and I watch them. You know, when things happen in families, and it's like, God, if they only had the tools of the program that we have, this wouldn't be such a big deal for them. So for that, you know, it's a gift. I wouldn't take anything. You know, I used to hear people say, I'm grateful for this disease, and I know what that means. I know exactly what that means today. I wouldn't take anything at all for it. Like I said, my mother did die 34 years sober. She was in a nursing home the last 6 months. She smoked. She was one of those with two cigarettes in her hand at every meeting. But while she was in that nursing home, a couple of AAs decided they want to take her to a Braves game. She was an avid Braves fan. And so they go out there, wheelchair and all, and then there was a young fella in Alateen. His father had died in this disease, unfortunately. He died before he got sober. And that was something him and his dad did, was go to the Braves game together. So they said, well, we're going to take him with us. And next thing you know, it's like 20 people, all program people, couple of people in wheelchairs, and we're off to the Braves game. And the nursing home got some footage out of that. They, you know, one of our people went to the Braves game, so the newspaper came out there and took pictures and made a big deal out of it. There was people in the program that came and took her to meetings, took her to anniversaries. I'd get a call at work, somebody'd say, is it okay for so-and-so to check your mother out? And I'd say, who? Because I didn't know anybody's last name. And I'd have to try to remember. So, yeah, that's okay. And I remember one time a guy that he got sober. I think Mama was about 5 years sober, and he told me this story. Mama had two ladies she ran with, and they evidently kind of took him under their wing when he first got sober, and he referred to them as his AA mamas. Said they loved him like his mama, like AA, until he could love himself. Well, he'd go out there and get her and take her to the meeting, and all the people at the nursing home, they wanted to know where they were going, what they were going to do. And he'd just say, we're going to a party. the nursing home that she was in when her health problems started, people in the program, AA and Al-Anon, started calling me, and they said, you need to talk to Janice. Well, I knew Janice was a nurse. I sponsored one of her little boy. But I had no idea what kind of nurse or, you know, whatever. Well, anyway, so after about 20 people telling me to talk to Janice, I called Janice. Well, she'd spent her whole life in elderly care, and she educated me. We spent about 2 hours on the phone that night, and she educated me about the process from get to go. She didn't work at that particular nursing home, but it's the one she recommended, and she'd been at all of them. About a year after Mama was there, she went back and went to work for that nursing home. And I'd see her at a meeting at night, and she'd say, thank God your mama was there. You know, I'd get all twisted up. I go to your mama's room and close the door, and we have a meeting. You know, she got the little big book in her drawer, and I don't know how much Mama knew or remembered or whatever. She could tell you who the president was in 1929, but she couldn't tell you what she had for breakfast this morning. So she didn't forget program, but I don't know how much, but you know what? Janice got what she needed. So I think about things like that, and it just goes, you know, the stories like that just go on and on and on and on. Pittsburgh, I told Irene I was going to tell the Pittsburgh story. Bunch of us went up to Pittsburgh for the Al-Anon International, and besides the hotel catching on fire while we was there, we was up on, I don't know, 12, 14 floors, and lady said, I sure wish they would tell us if this is a drill or not before we make Irene run, walk down 14 flights of steps. And I look out the window, and there's like 10 fire trucks down there and smoke boiling out, and I said, it ain't a drill. We need to go. Well, I look around, everybody's gone. I mean, Irene beat me to the bottom. And Kitty and all of them, what's Rick's title, the director of Al-Anon or whatever? He's standing at the elevator wondering what's taking the elevator so long. He didn't know there was a fire. So anyways, people told us we need to eat at this particular restaurant somewhere downtown. So we go down there, and we fool around and miss the last bus coming back. And it's getting dark, downtown Pittsburgh. We're in the hood now. Well, we start walking. About, I don't know, 10 of us, I guess. And Irene and Kitty, boy, they just... Those two right there, don't try to keep up with them. And so anyway, what a trip. You know, and just story after story after story like that. Taking kids around. We've taken van loads of kids. I've hauled kids all over this country to tell their story. When they get an Alateen that's willing to do this, everybody wants them to talk. We went, young feller got invited, the guy that got took, the kid that got took to the Braves game, he got invited to tell his story over in Louisiana. So we rent this big van and four Al-Anons, four Alateen sponsors and a bunch of kids. We go to Louisiana so he could tell his story. And all of us in, this is during football season, and LSU was doing pretty well, and we're all in our Roll Tide attire. We left there, and one of the kids said, I want to eat. Let's go eat in Texas. I want to say I've been to Texas. So we drive 20 miles in the other direction so this kid can say I ate lunch in Texas. I mean, what kind of crazy? That's what kind of stuff we do in the program. We're on the way home. It's like a 12-hour drive. We're on the way home, and there's about 10 or 12 of us. And Kitty called, said, where are y'all? You hungry? Have you ate supper? I said, well, we're going to stop here pretty soon. It's getting on up late. And she said, well, just come on to my house, and I want to cook for y'all. We get there at like 10 o'clock at night. She's got a full course meal, pot roast and two, three vegetables and dessert, and I mean the whole nine yards. And some of these people she didn't even know. You know, she invited us in the middle of the night on a work night. This was Sunday night. And into her home and cooked. She must have cooked all afternoon. I mean, a full course meal. She's smiling. And we just bombarded her house right there in the middle of the night. I mean, where else do you do that other than in this program? That doesn't happen out there. It doesn't happen out there. Washington. Went to the AA International in 2010. Standing there, me and another guy, we had a plan. We was going to get up front. So he comes in one door and I come in the other, and our job is to make a beeline to the front as soon as they open the gate and get a close-up front seat. So we're fourth from the stage. And the stage is like 20 foot tall. You know, we're looking up like this. Well, when they stood up to do the prayer, I turned around and looked around, and there's 60,000 of us there. And Mickey had told me about it. She was in that very place the year I was born, her and Jim. So I kind of knew what to expect. And I told Ray, I said, look around. He's looking around. What am I looking for? And I said, and you thought you were the only one. And first time I went to a really big roundup that had 400 or 500 people, I thought it was something special to say the Lord's Prayer with 400 or 500 people. We said the Lord's Prayer with 60,000 people. That just, I'm getting chills right now just thinking about that. But what a trip. It was a lady in my home group, an elderly lady. She decided the night before she wanted to go with us. So I'm on the phone with the guy in Atlanta that had made some reservations. I knew he had internet access, try to get her a plane ticket. And she's got her credit card. And we're out there in the parking lot at the meeting, trying to get at 9:30 at night, trying to get this lady a flight for tomorrow to go to this international with us. We had rented a bed and breakfast and decided whoever went, we was all just going to split it. You know, no whining about your bed's bigger or smaller. You know, just whatever it costs divided by however many people, that's what your take was. So she wanted to add on. We're thinking, yeah, that's less for me, you know. So he gets her a plane ride that's 2 hours ahead of Ray and I. Because everything's full by this time. Well, she gets to the Toronto airport, and her job's to wait 2 hours, and then Ray and I's going to find her. Well, we got almost to Toronto. We could see the lights, and the pilot said, the plane's broke. We're going back to Chicago. So we turned her, made a big U-turn, turned around. Well, we're like 6 hours late getting there, and she solicited the help of the people at the airport to find us. Well, she didn't know our last name. She knew what flight we were on, but it never arrived. So she found some other people from Alabama and hitched a ride with them, went to their hotel, and we get in 1, 2 o'clock in the morning, start calling people. Anybody know where Carolyn is? We finally caught up with her, but you don't do that kind of stuff out, you know, outside of this program. You know, the full total trust of, you know, we know who each other are. Whether we know you or not, we know you on both sides. One thing I should say, over the years I've encountered a little bit of resistance with AA and Al-Anon, which I never had that because I grew up around AA from early age. But there's some AAs that don't really like Al-Anons, and there's some Al-Anons that don't like AAs, or they're scared to death of them, or still angry, or whatever. I've had the opportunity a number of times to be that person in the middle. You know, I don't have any, I long since over my resentment of AA. So to me, I can hear an AA share or say something, and I get what I need. I can hear an Alateen share and say something, I get what I need. And there are no lines. There's no prejudice. There's no this or that or the other. And I've had the opportunity to break that wall down for some people on both sides of the hall. And that is a true honor. A true honor. And it wasn't something I set out to do, but it's like, you know what? If you don't like Al-Anon, I need to talk to you because there's some people in your life that's hurting. And some of those people that so hated Al-Anon, they go to Al-Anon today. And one lady, great big lady, she's probably 400 pounds at least, she calls me her favorite little Al-Anon. Now she comes with her arms wide open. And she made a lot of noise about how bad we are. So today, you know, she loves us like we love her. And so anyway, I'm about out of time. I could go on and on and on with stories, but it is huge, huge honor to be able to be here, let alone talk here. I love this place. It's very special. There's a lot of new faces this time, a lot of old faces not here. There's a whole bunch of people I miss not being here. But for the new faces, I hope this place does for you just a tiny bit of what it's done for me, and you'll be back, and you'll bring other people back. This is a truly, truly spiritual, special place, and very, very special people. So thank you for listening.